Land tax, stamp duty, tenants. Sure, property is great, but there are easier ways to get your passive income, sometimes with franking credits. Through ETFs or exchange-traded funds, you can buy a basket of shares in many different companies in one trade. BetaShares offers Australia's broadest range of ETFs, including income-focused funds, which aim to provide yield-hungry investors with attractive income streams. Discover the BetaShares range of ETFs and how simple they can be to invest in by going to betashares.com.au. Read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website and consider if the fund is right for you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a podcast by the Rask Group. It's for educational purposes only. So please do not make a financial, legal, investment or taxation decision based on solely what you hear in this show.
Welcome to the Australian Property Podcast.
We're on a mission to be Australia's most trusted property podcast.
I'm Owen Rask, founder of the Rask Group.
I'm Pete Wargent, author and buyer's agent.
I'm Amy Linardi, and I am a buyer's agent.
I'm Chris Bates, ex-financial planner and mortgage broker.
Together, we'll take you through every step of your property journey.
From first home buyer to decades of property investing. G'day, welcome to the Australian Property Podcast. Very special episode for you today. We've got a special guest, Dr. Cameron Murray, author of The Great Housing Hijack, which is all over the media and the news channels this week. Cameron, welcome. It's great to have you on.
Oh, thanks for having me, Pete.
The book with the longest subtitle I can remember, The Hoaxes and Myths Keeping Prices High for Renters and Buyers in Australia. Got all the key buzzwords in there. So, yeah, Cam, before we kick off, I've read a bit about the book in the media and I've read the book myself now. Very interesting stuff. But just to do a brief intro, tell us a bit about your background and who you are.
I'm an economist. These days, I call myself the chief economist of Fresh Economic Thinking, which is my one-man think tank consulting outfit that I've started. And it's where I write about housing and any other economic topic. The last 4 years, I was actually at the University of Sydney as a research fellow, just researching housing supply and housing economics. And before that, I've worked in government departments for property developers. I've invested in property myself. So that's sort of my story and where I'm at. And the book is a culmination of probably 20 years of frustration with the state of the housing debate. It's just things go around in circle. We never seem to agree on what the problem is or what the market would deliver if left to its own devices. And I just figured it's about time to just set things straight, just lay out all the economics I've learned, all the myths I've observed that don't make any sense, put it in one place and try and level up the quality of the discussion.
You definitely do that. And there's a few people caught in the crossfire in the book, which was interesting and exciting to read. Give us an insight into the 18-year-old Cameron Murray. Why did you choose to go into economics? What was it you were hoping to achieve by becoming an economist?
The 18-year-old me was actually studying aerospace engineering. And thought, look, I'm pretty good at maths and I'm pretty good sort of at abstract reasoning. I'm a bit of a nerd. Why don't I just do something that seems really hard? Why not? And that was 2000. And after that, I studied a year, took a gap year, went and worked in the ski fields in Canada, that sort of stuff. And so I was 19 when I came back and realized that being an engineer is really hard. You got to do a lot of work. These guys selling real estate, they're just making easy money why don't I just make the easy money? Why? What's this all about? So I actually tried selling real estate at Harcourts Clayfield in Brisbane. Was a terrible real estate agent, but really got interested in economics and property. And around that time, I also bought my first house with a very early banker mum and dad. The reason for that was my dad had cancer, and essentially he wanted to set up us kids financially. He's still alive today. He got through with all the chemo and that, but you know, the legacy is he really did set us up, gave us $30,000 each and said, buy a house, get invested, take responsibility. And that was sort of the real start of, oh, you make money on this. Oh, there's options for investing and renovating and renting to different people. And, you know, this market is enormous. So that was the real start and sort of spiraled from there, worked. I did a property economics degree. After that, worked for a couple of developers, went and worked for the government, and it just spiraled.
Yeah, interesting. I didn't realize you'd been a real estate agent. For my sins, I also have a real estate license these days, even though my background was as a CA. So, it's an interesting industry, a lot of characters, I guess. One of the things that jumped out from the book, actually, was struck me as interesting is that quite often with housing market debates, you get some people who are sort of very pro-property, either landlords or work for developers or, I don't know, the Housing Industry Association. Then you get other people who are younger people who are maybe renters or new arrivals to Australia, and they think the whole thing's a massive clusterfuck, basically. But it was interesting to see because you've variously through the journey being a renter but also a landlord, and it kind of, I suppose, it's given you an insight into the symmetry of a housing market, i.e. you know, one person's income as a landlord is another person's expense, and there's always two sides, a bit like the old double entry bookkeeping. So that was one of the interesting sections of the book where you talk about how in the housing market, even though well, it's quite dynamic, I suppose. It's ever-changing. And although the debate tends to be skewed one way or the other, but actually there's a kind of a symmetry between how everything functions.
Yeah, look, I think I didn't really have a word for that or a way to describe it for many years. But it always seemed to me that we would have a debate about one topic and ignore the other side of the market. Oh, rents need to go down, prices need to go down. I'm like, well, aren't you just wiping off billions from the value of people's homes? So I think once you acknowledge that, and I call it in the book the symmetry of property markets, you really see why policy doesn't do anything. We've had inquiries about rising rents, house prices, first home buyings pretty much every electoral cycle for 100 plus years. I note the 1910 New South Wales rents inquiry was shocked at the rising rents in Sydney in the early first decade of the 1900s, and they had their inquiry, and then again 9 years later there was another federal inquiry into the same problem, and we've pretty much had them ever since, and nothing really changes. And I think politically that's because of this symmetry. There is an abnormal period after the Second World War in Australia and in many countries where we really did intervene. But in the normal course of political events, we're not in the business of regulating the rents of 18% of households who are landlords who earn $60 billion of rental income a year, right? Dropping rents 10% is $6 billion you're essentially stealing every year from the most well-connected 18% of households. So I think once you acknowledge that, it really puts into perspective why the debate goes around in circles, why I say it's been hijacked. Some interest groups, you know, property developers, they don't want to be taxed. Landlords don't want their rents regulated or to be taxed. And they can get away with pretending that, no, if you just let us be, oh, taxing us is bad, but we'll voluntarily do something that makes rents cheap. Right? Like, which is it? Is it bad for you to make less money or is it good? You can't just switch your story around. Yeah, that symmetry is the heart of the issue.
Yeah, well, that's something that always comes up when the Green Party is talking about rental price caps and so on, which have been variously tried in other countries. And but I guess a landlord's perspective on that would be, well, yeah, but when rents were falling in Brisbane 6 or 7 years ago, there was nobody saying we should cap the downside. Now you want to cap the upside. And I guess there's all the old debates about whether price caps or price controls work in economics anyway. I think as well, sometimes we see a little bit of this on the negative gearing debate, where people say, well, if we wind back negative gearing benefits, it will save the budget $4 billion a year. But as you said, there's always another side to the transaction. You know, if an investor buys a property, there's stamp duty that gets paid to the state government, the bank writes a loan, which is ultimately taxed by corporation taxes. And, you know, if you're going to sort of knock out some parts of the market, well, there's other revenue streams there which aren't accounted for. And yeah, well, I guess that's, as you said, there's always two sides to every transaction. And maybe that's why we get so many contradictions in the commentary and for academia and so on. Cameron, we were chatting just before we came on, actually. So this is a two-part question. You've done a good section in the book that explains asset price equilibrium and how do we arrive at the price of a house in a market situation. But it was also in the news this very week in New Zealand that there was talk about introducing effectively a price to income target for the housing market. And thinking back to my time in London back in the mid-1990s, there was a lot of talk at the time, largely through academia, about how the housing market should have a price to income ratio of about 3 times. There was a magic number. A house price should be 3 times a person's income. But it was never really discussed why 3 times was the magic number, how people ever got to that number in the first place. And then prices went to 5 times income and it didn't really ever revert. And so I guess you did a really good explainer in the book. Can you enlighten us? So a price of a house in Clayfield these days might be $1 million, but how does it even end up being $1 million? Because presumably it costs less than $1 million to build a house. So where does the asset price
come from? That's right. So I think, yeah, you're right, Pete. This, you're getting to the heart of the question here. We have a lot of talk about, the price is the wrong price, right? The market price, it's bad, it's wrong. But the question should be, why is that the market price? Because market prices just can't do anything, right? There are major forces at play, and that's what I talk about in the book. And I talk of five, what I call equilibria in property markets, 5 ways that we can trade our way to determining the rents and prices or the density or whatever else. And so the asset price equilibria is basically the result of this trade-off. I can buy a property with $1 million, or I can buy any other asset in the economy with $1 million, right? And so the relative rates of return, total rates of return, capital gains and net incomes, really can't deviate very much between those things, because otherwise I'll sell property and I'll buy something else. Now, you might say, oh, people need a place to live, but of course, you know, more than a third of trades are investor trades, right? And they will set the market. If investors all want to sell at once, we can crash the price. And if investors all want to buy at once, that will also change the price. And so it's this trade-off of, well, I've got $1 million. I can either buy an apartment and get a 5% gross yield, might be 3% net, plus I'll get some capital growth of a few percent. That's great. Okay. If other assets in the economy with a similar risk profile are getting 5 to 7% or whatever it is, then that's price sort of makes sense, right? If prices fell by half, which some people think might happen if we just let the market do its thing, well, that $1 million apartment is going to be $500,000 and you're going to be making 10% gross yield, right? Plus any capital gains, you're talking 12 or 15%. Other assets in the economy are getting 5 or 7, that just can't be sustained, right? Or people would pull all their money out of other assets and buy houses until the price went up and the yields were comparable again. because it's the price of the year, the return that is equalized across asset markets. And there's a caveat there, I would say, in expectation, right? Like, no one gets it right. These are all guesses. So this is why it can seem like property is overpriced. But of course, for the buyer, they have justified it because they don't have to buy, but that buyer has justified it, saying, well, there's nothing better to do with that money at this point in time. I'll just hope that capital gains make the investment worthwhile.
That scenario you've just outlined there, though, there's an assumption that the rental income presumably stays, give or take, the same. And I think you even do cover this in the book, how rents, for whatever reason, which you've tried to explain for lay people in the book, such as myself, the rents in the economy seem to be tied to incomes, whether it's 25% of income seems to get spent on rent. But is there a scenario there where the price could fall and rents could fall as well, presumably if supply was increased?
Oh, well, yeah, okay. So rents could fall, but they can't fall without everyone's incomes falling, because the reason rents are 20% of income, and this is an interesting thing, if you take the survey of income and housing from 1990 to 1992, they did this survey, I think they do it over a two-year period, and you ask all the renters what their income is and what they pay for rent, you get 20% on average for private renters. If you do it again in 1995, 2001, 2010, 2016, 2021, all those surveys find flat lines of rent-to-income ratios for private renters. And the question there, the same thing happens in the UK, the same thing happens in the US, the same things happen in Canada. And in fact, if you go back to that 1910 New South Wales inquiry and look at some archived evidence of wages and rents, it's pretty much 20% then as well, right? So rents grow with income. And the question then is, well, why? Like, you know, TVs get cheaper compared to income. And I think the reason is pretty simple, but it's a bit of a conceptual shift. Houses are not just an item or a product like a TV or a t-shirt or whatever. They are also a complete category of expenditure in your household. And you can get more housing by getting a better location. And so if the price of houses go down and I could pay 10% of my income, well, I'll be like, well, I should buy more housing. Not, why don't I move to a better suburb and pay the extra 5% to be in a better suburb instead of paying 5% of my income on other stuff? It's kind of weird to live in a poor suburb and have a fancy car and a great job. I should be spending more on housing. And so we bid ourselves up by shifting to new locations, reducing the number of people per household and building bigger houses until we get back to that 20% point. And in fact, if you wanted rents to be 5 or 10% of income, you would need to prohibit trades and relocations in the housing market. And the only example I could find historically of where rents in the private market were 5 to 10% of income was in Vienna after the First World War, where there were massive rent controls and rents were regulated at their pre-war level. And the way they could keep that is because they stopped people trading and individually moving and paying other renters to move out. They had a central clearinghouse. So if you wanted to move, you had to go to the central government, say, hey, I've got an extra couple of kids now. I'd like a bigger place, but you're not letting me outbid these other people. If someone with a bigger place, you know, has people die and moves into a small place, can you get them to swap with me? Right? So that's how you do it. Otherwise, people would just keep moving to bigger and better places and bidding up that rent. And so what you see over history, rent's 20% of income. So we have inflation right now. We have wage growth right now. Well, of course, rents are going to go up with wages or household incomes.
Right. So, yeah. So, I think there's definitely some examples of where government intervention might have changed things. But actually, you're right. Thinking back to my own sort of journey, that is more or less exactly how it's gone. You know, I remember back in the pre-GFC days where you know, my budget might have been, I've got $500 a week. It's the best I can afford. You know, get a two-bedroom unit to rent or something. And then when our incomes went up, oh, we can get a unit that looks over the harbour, you know, $750 a week. And then later on, you know, budget's $3,000 a week, and it's like, right, we're moving up to a big bloody house with a pool and view over the golf course. But the starting point is always, how much can we spend? You know, it's not, the starting point is not looking at the market. And I suppose that, I mean, it makes perfect sense. I guess that's why people spend what they can afford within reason, and then apply that to the market. You mentioned that actually location and people wanting to be in better locations. And you talk in the book about spatial equilibrium and people often wanting to be close to the best amenities, or you know, whether it's the beach or whatever drives that, or employment hubs and things like that. And you talked to, I think, I remember reading in real estate books 25 years ago, people say you should try and, if you're going to be an investor in property, go for the ripple effect. So you've got this sort of high price suburbs. We'll go to the next best one because eventually people get priced out and they move on to the next. You term that as effectively a bridesmaid suburb. So is that is that roughly a model of how the housing market works? Is that people go for the best locations, and then if they get priced out or pushed out to those suburbs, then people move on to the next best alternative?
Exactly. I mean, that's how people shop for real estate, but it's also how the market adjusts over time. And I think you can sort of link that back with this rental effect I was talking about with incomes. If higher incomes rise first during a boom period, well, those people want the best areas. And so they move there, or they rent there, or they buy there. And that creates this price differential, which means that those areas become relatively less attractive than they used to be, and the nearby areas become relatively more attractive for the price, and they go up. Because, you know, if people were paying, for example, a $200 a week premium to live in the name brand suburb, you know, something Heights versus, you know, something by the swamp, that $200, people could move anytime they want for $200 to move to the more premium part. Now, if the more premium part goes up to $400, people are like, well, I used to only be willing to pay $200 to live here. I can actually save $400 by moving out to the next suburb. And so that one adjusts until that gap is sort of what the value premium is for shifting from one to the other. And I think, the bridesmaid suburb idea is just that these gaps can't be sustained. And when markets move, they don't just all move simultaneously in perfect, even harmony. It's not, prices don't go up 5% everywhere per year. They sort of ripple up in certain areas. But over time, you can capitalize on that, those abnormal gaps. So, for example, even when Brisbane is abnormally cheap compared to Sydney, you know that that gap is going to adjust if you give it enough time. So typically Brisbane's between 60 and 80% of the price of Sydney, and pre-COVID it was 60%, and now it's up to 70-something percent, right? Because those gaps just can't get bigger, or people will leave Sydney and come to Brisbane. That's what spatial equilibrium means. It means if people are allowed to move, they'll move until the quality of life is equalized. That is, there's no extra gains for them from moving because the cost outweighs the extra gains.
That's why we moved to Queensland ourselves. So we were living in Sydney eastern suburbs, but then decided to have kids. And it's like, well, hang on, the price of a house is 2.2 times as expensive in Sydney as it is in Brisbane. Why don't we just move? We'll just relocate to where you can get more space for the same amount of money. And as you said as well, apologies, this is very Queensland-focused examples, but if you look at a suburb like Woolloongabba or somewhere like that, where, you know, it's basically just a few rough pubs where people would go after the cricket finished or after the AFL, but then, you know, it's relatively much cheaper than some of the surrounding suburbs, despite being so close to everything. Then you get, you know, the Cross River Rail and the investment, new stadium upgrade, and then eventually that gap will close. It's there might be a period there where, you know, the suburb is gentrifying, but the gap won't stay as wide as it has been, because ultimately people will be pushed out of the new farms and the Tenerifes and end up in the cheaper alternative that's nearby. Cam, on the Queensland theme, there's a bit of a thought experiment here to explore with you. So you talk a bit about density equilibrium in the book. And if you go through Brisbane CBD, not so much at the moment, but 6 or 7 years ago, there were cranes everywhere, big tower blocks going up, including the Sky Tower, actually, which I think alongside the Meriton goes up to pretty much the high limit for building, which is, 274 metres or whatever?
Correct.
So basically as high as you go without getting taken out by a Qantas jet. But then you talk in the book about Beenleigh, which is down towards the Loganshire, where the zoning would allow for 90 metre builds. But actually in both cases, it's not like if you go to Brisbane CBD, there aren't tower blocks everywhere, even though the zoning would allow for it. There are not dozens of tower blocks that go up to that kind of height limit. And certainly if you go down into the Loganshire, there are not loads of 90 metre tower blocks. The zoning is effectively rarely used. So can you explain to me what, I assume that's partly driven by the demand for actually living in tower blocks that are 250 metres up and the ability of developers to actually build that profitably and sell it. But can you explain to us about the density equilibrium thing? Because obviously this has some implications for policy going forward.
That's right. So the density equilibrium is just one of those extra forces. So we've talked about the asset equilibrium where people trade from one asset to property and prices just can't do anything, right? They're tied to other markets. That's true for rents as well. Rents can't just do anything. They're tied to incomes and our other consumer choices. And density is the same as well. There's two things you need to understand about density. The first is that on a per unit of dwelling area basis, the cost, the construction and development cost rises with density. Right, that is why. And secondly, people value better locations, right? And because of that, that means that only in high value locations is it worthwhile building a taller building, because the cost of going from 5 stories to 10 stories might be $5,000 a square meter. You can't sell an apartment for $5,000 a square meter in Beenleigh, right? So you can't, there's no way to make money building a tall building. This is why high-value areas have tall buildings and cheap areas don't have tall buildings, because it's just not worth it, right? You're losing money because the construction costs higher than the market value, so you build small buildings. And so we have this interesting interaction between what the optimal density is at any market price. And so when market prices rise, every site, the optimal density or the density that hypothetically you could do to make more money if you decided to develop, and that's an if, not every site is developed, it rises with the market. And it falls when there's a market crash. You get shorter buildings built in the same locations. And so I often say that every building is built at the wrong density, because there is a split second in time when you decide to build where you can optimize that. And after the market changes, whether that's construction costs or market prices, your building's the wrong density before it's finished. And so we have interesting situations where in Beenleigh, they're like, oh, we need more density and more houses, so let's just let people build anything. And 20 years later, the tallest building's 5 or 8 stories tall. There's only one of them, and it's probably been a financially terrible decision. Okay, so they're trying to, the planning scheme's here, but the economic limit, this density equilibrium's down here. Then you get to some inner city suburbs in Sydney where people will pay $15,000 a square meter for an apartment, and building taller only costs $10,000, and you've got the planning constraint here and the density equilibrium here. And so that's the situation where property owners will try and argue, planning's constraining supply, give me this little bit of extra profit for exceeding the planning limit, because in this location it makes me more money. So that's sort of the density equilibrium. And of course it makes sense. You get tall buildings during property cycles when prices are rising, because tall buildings make sense when prices are higher. And you get tall buildings in high value cities, but not in country towns, even if you're allowed to do them, because the cost of going higher, the cost of density rises with density. And, you know, each market has a price level that restricts that density.
One of the locations where the high rise thing really took off in the preceding cycle was Parramatta, but I think a lot of that stock was really funded by investors from China, and I think they were sold on the basis of having good views and being a way to invest your money elsewhere out of China. But I mean, there haven't been great investments in a lot of cases. And I think it will be a struggle now, I think, to do equivalent developments of high, big tower blocks, I think, with certainly with domestically funded investors, because I just don't think that the sales would be there. And as you say, construction costs have gone up a lot. Cam, your previous book was called Game of Mates. And I guess there is a bit of a common theme here in terms of vested interests. You talk in the book about politicians. I mean, most politicians seem to be property owners, often property investors. In fact, most voters in the economy, I guess, across the whole electorate, most voters would be homeowners or have a property somewhere. I think in academia sometimes, well, there's been a lot of high-profile issues, not really related to Aussie housing, but just generally about the role of funding in academia. I was chatting to somebody this week, and they were saying how the Domain website is used much more in New South Wales by a lot of people. And I said, well, from memory, the Sydney Morning Herald has a big domain pullout every weekend. Yeah. And I guess the media itself is in some way tied into a certain view of the housing market, being affiliated with the real estate portals and so on. So you do get certain media angles, but also developers, housing market providers. So the policy debate, I guess the point you're making is that it's there's a lot of vested interests that are weaved or are woven, I suppose, all the way through that debate. Would that be a fair assessment?
That's a very fair assessment, and that's why it's the great housing hijack. Everyone's got an interest in hijacking the debate for themselves. Academics don't get off the hook. They want to find ever more obscure issues with housing markets. The media can, if prices are falling, then we can have headlines, double whammy for investors, rents and prices falling. We can also have the headline that falling prices, crushing supply, future crisis, impending. And then you can have the reverse when prices are rising. You can have suburbs where prices are rising the most, suburbs where they're falling the most. You know, the media's interest is in clicks. And so you get only the most extreme. Democratically, we have a bit of an issue with 67% home ownership. That sort of eliminates, I think, electorally any substantial changes to the housing market. And of course, politicians themselves have 2.5 dwellings on average. If they're worth $1 million each, we're talking $2.5 million of assets. There are over 6,000 politicians in the country at council, state, and federal level. We're talking $13 billion of real estate assets by that group of people, ignoring their family and friends' portfolios. So, yeah, everyone's sort of got an interest. No one has an interest in just saying straight, what does the housing market do? What's this equilibrium? Why do rents go up with incomes? You know, what can housing markets actually do and what can they not do? We have one side who says, let markets rip. Markets will do this magic thing that they've never done before. And another side that's sort of interested in taxes might say, oh, we need to tax things differently. That will solve housing. I'm like, well, probably, you know, we'll change tax revenue sources. But, you know, people will say stamp duty is really bad, for example, right? It's a favorite one. Well, New Zealand hasn't had stamp duty for 30 years. The housing market's terrible, right? And we ignore the fact that they have a greater turnover of investors, so investors trade more often because the cost is lower. And of course, that means renters are forced to move more often when the landlord sells in New Zealand because stamp duty's zero. And some people think, you know, getting rid of stamp duty is going to solve housing somehow. So yeah, there's all these interest groups hijacking the debate. And as I said, after 20 years looking at property, someone just needed to place it there and say, look, this is a coherent way of understanding the market. Here's all the nonsense myths and the reasons people are motivated to promote them. Here are things that have worked. So that's what I did.
Beautiful. So you're known as a heterodox economist, I think it would be fair to say, or at least somebody with an independent range of thought. And over the years, I've enjoyed reading some of your work on the market cycle and how to understand when it might be a good time to buy or sell based on your indices. But Cam, before today's interview, I put out a message on social media yesterday saying, do you have any questions for Cameron? If so, just drop them below. Interesting that a lot of the messages I got were direct messages. So sometimes from people who would rather remain anonymous, I guess. But there's a section in the book called Zoning Zealots, and a lot of the questions related to this. So I guess there's a big debate about upzoning and whether rezoning can help to fix, in inverted commas, the housing market and supply going forward. It seems to be a hotly contested debate. There's something that always amuses me in academia, how the debate can often be polite and yet somehow rude at the same time, which is always it's great grabbing the popcorn and sitting on the sidelines. I don't think I could ever work in academia because I've got too much of a potty mouth, I think. But give us a 2-minute overview. What is the debate? And I've had Peter Tulip on my podcast previously, and we talked for a good hour about his view of the housing market. But give us an overview. What is the debate all about, and what's your take on it?
So the way I see it, I'll try and sort of steelman them. The argument is that planning regulations on density, that is dwellings per square meter or per site, also have the effect of being regulations on dwellings per period of time, the number of new dwellings built per year. And of course, if there are fewer new dwellings per year, that's a decline in supply. And if the number of households and their incomes are the same, then of course prices will be higher because we'll squeeze more people into fewer houses. Even if they're just paying the same fixed share of their income, rents will go up and therefore prices, because there's more people per dwelling because there's not enough homes relative to a counterfactual. There are a couple of issues with that. Is that your understanding, Pete? That seems fair, do you think?
Yeah, and look, a lot of it seems to revolve around Auckland, which has been through a reform. And yeah, okay. I mean, I was actually, as in preparation for this interview, I did a bit of reading, and at least in nominal terms, rents in Auckland have started increasing again as supply has eased off. And I guess that debate sort of remains unresolved. I'm kind of on the fence with this one. I can see both sides of the debate. I think all things being equal, with looser zoning restrictions, I guess over the long run, the equilibrium price should in theory be lower than it might otherwise be, but wouldn't necessarily reduce prices. I guess that's my sort of... sort of middle of the road kind of view, if you like.
We can unpack this for a bit. So a couple of things. Firstly, limits on density are not limits on how many dwellings can be built. And I think that's a hidden assumption here, that if you're allowed to build 50 dwellings on this site or 100, if you were allowed to build 100, you would build them in the exact same period of time. Therefore, there would be twice as many dwellings. But you don't have to build them in the same period of time. You can, instead of building this other site with 50 dwellings, sell this one for twice as long, right? That's why big projects are risky. It takes a long time for big towers to pre-sell 80% or whatever they want to sell out of a huge tower. It takes ages. And that's why so many large projects have multiple approvals and redesigns before they ever get built, because you got to meet the market and find something people are willing to pay for before you commit to all that construction cost. And so I think that's the key thing, because there is plenty of places to put houses, but the owners of those properties don't want to put houses on them now, because putting houses on them tomorrow might make them more money, right? They don't have to do it today. Undeveloped land is an asset that makes you a return by going up in value over time. And the short run economic model, I think, in the head of many people is that no, it's like bananas, right? You have a good growing season, then you're flush with bananas, and you have to sell them all in the same period of time, because next year there'll be more bananas, right? But it's not like that at all. It's more like building container ships or oil tankers. You don't just build them by accident. You build them when someone orders them, right? And you don't just go, oh, I can build 20 container ships, so I'll just build them and cross my fingers that someone will pay. No. You wait for them to order, and you literally match supply with the rate at which the market arrives to build them. So it's a build to order model. Now, it's true that planning regulations restrict where different types of buildings go, but of course that's what they're designed for, right? We might want more density here, but not here. And so we create this line, imaginary line in the planning scheme, and people go, see, you zoned area A for high rise, but not area B, and area A got all these extra dwellings. And we'll be like, yes, that's right. That's how the planning scheme's meant to work. You're meant to build them where it's zoned and not where it's not zoned. And there's another conflation of always, yeah, seeing this substitution into locations and assuming that it's a change in the aggregate, that, oh, if area B was also upzoned, that'd have equally as many extra towers as area A. But that's not true. And we can see in the data, right, the number of dwellings can double, like approved, can double or triple and then collapse all of a sudden. And the question is, well, if you could build twice as many last year, why aren't you building twice as many this year? There must be some kind of market constraint. And so in the book, I have a chapter on this. It's called the absorption rate equilibrium. It's another one of those things where there's a trade-off between building faster today or building faster tomorrow across the market as a whole. And you don't want to build faster today if it makes you less money tomorrow. And so this is the sort of natural trade-off everywhere. And to go even further, if you banned building new houses in Sydney, I think in 10 years prices would be lower. Right? Because everyone would leave Sydney. All the construction industry would leave. It wouldn't be a boom town, right? It would just be this sort of museum town. Maybe there'll be some rich people there, but I just don't see it being the case. And Noosa is a good example, Pete. I think I put it in the book. Noosa is essentially, if you look at the data, they're an actual place that has banned development, essentially. But do you know what? Prices there haven't risen faster than anywhere else on the Sunshine Coast. That premium, that spatial premium is exactly the same. People just substitute to other parts of the coast. So I think these are the big things. I have two other concerns about zoning. One is it's a gift of property rights to existing property owners that has a market price. We should sell it, right? Property rights are not these absolute things, and we could raise lots of money for it. So it's not costless. So do it. If you want different shaped cities, fine. That's you know, up for the people to hash out. But if you think we're going to somehow trick property owners into flooding the market and building lots of houses really cheap, then, you know, just look at history before zoning. Housing was expensive. It was crap. No one owned it. Home ownership in Australian cities was 40% before zoning existed. It's 67% now. If I had good examples where this worked, I would do it. And Auckland is one of the favorite examples. But of course, few things. One of the most famous papers had some very strange methodology. If you go to fresheconomicthinking.com, search Auckland myth or something like that, you'll see the details of that. It's also the case now that Auckland rents are rising fastest in the country, even though the net additions to dwellings are the highest they've been. Because you can look at dwelling consents, but that's not how many extra homes there are, right? Because if you're doing townhouses, which was the type of upzoning in Auckland, you've got to knock houses down to build them, right? So, and it takes years. So, yeah, a consent line can go up, but it might take 3 or 4 years before the actual number of dwellings you can live in increases. And in the last 12 months, that's been increasing at its fastest rate, yet rents have been rising at their fastest rate for a decade.
Actually, Brisbane itself is a reasonable case study, because if you look at the previous cycle, there was a lot of overbuilding around the inner suburbs. So you might use a different terminology, I suppose, to overbuilding, but there was a lot of cranes. It just got to the point where people were getting very twitchy, going, well, there's cranes everywhere here. This probably isn't a good time to be buying. And eventually the developers around places like Newstead, where I was living at the time, yeah, they just sold off their excess stock. They couldn't shift it to build apartments, and rents mm-hmm. actually fell in the area. It was a great time to be on the rental side of the equation, not so much for landlords. But then things have gone the other way, and asking rents are up 50% in the last 3 years for units in yep. Brisbane. Yeah, I'll get myself into trouble here because I'm just looking out the window to the golf course, which is something which always gets people's shackles up. in the NIMBY versus YIMBY debate. But one of the things, when I had Peter Tulip on the podcast, we talked about externalities. And I guess thinking back to how Sydney was impacted by the apartment construction boom, and Brisbane to some extent, in terms of traffic and making the place somehow less livable. And Peter's argument was, but if you actually look at when there was a big flood of supply, it didn't reduce prices in some of those areas where there was the biggest amount of construction. And I said, well, isn't that a, my sort of counterpoint, well, isn't that a debate, isn't that a point that is saying, well, the extra supply hasn't reduced prices? But his take on it, a bit to almost to paraphrase Joseph Stalin, that quality has a quantity has a quality all of its own. But he's saying, look, across the breadth of the housing market, it would actually keep rents lower than would otherwise be the case. And I see one of the questions that was fielded on social media from Peter Tulip, what is the, well, I'll just quote him directly, what is the most important disagreement between Cameron and mainstream urban economics, and what can be done to resolve that disagreement? So I think we've touched on some of it already, but is there more to it?
No, the most important disagreement is that most economics and most urban economics doesn't have time in the denominator of any analysis, right? There is no concept of this flow rate of new dwellings per period of time or this intertemporal trade-off between today and tomorrow. That was an exaggeration. There are some economists. I have an article called Crampton versus Crampton. So Eric Crampton's a Kiwi economist, and he... I'll explain this because it gets to the fundamental point. There was a concern in New Zealand that they had an emissions trading scheme, right, where you could plant trees to get emissions credits, right? And the concern was, well, if anyone can just plant trees on their farm anytime and get credits, and it costs, you know, $5 to plant a tree, won't the value of emissions credits just collapse to $5 as people flood the market with trees? And Eric Crampton said, no, that's not right, because you've got to understand the property owners can plant trees tomorrow, and they're maximizing this long-run present value of the stream of revenue from planting trees. And so they won't just flood the market by planting $5 trees until the value of a carbon credit comes down to $5. And he quoted this Harold Hotelling model from the 1930s that basically explained that property owners just don't voluntarily crash the value of an underlying asset because they have the option to invest in it. And I thought it was really funny because Eric Crampton is very much like Peter Tulip, arguing that, oh, if we do this for houses, people will crash the value of houses. But if we do it for carbon credits and trees, no, that won't happen. And so I basically rewrote Eric's article, and I confined and replaced the word tree with house and carbon credit with house price. And it makes total sense still, because that's exactly the economic logic at play. And so that's sort of, I guess it's my main disagreement with some urban economists, but not all of them. There's plenty out there who see that intertemporal trade-off that I see as well.
Did you legitimately take somebody else's article and do a control replace on the word trees?
Yeah, I did do that, actually. It's one of my favorite articles.
That sounds to me like the sort of thing that a professional shit stirrer would do rather than a...
Yeah, it was. I know that it was shit stirring, but it was just so well explained. And I was just like, this guy's been arguing this exact point for me. He's just explained my argument perfectly. But if I change the word, he will change his argument. I'm like, where's the economics here? And so, if anyone wants to understand it, let Eric Crampton explain the economics.
I'll take your point. So, Cameron, before I'm going to do a quick fire on some of these questions on Twitter. Before we do, one other thing. So negative gearing is probably going to come back into the debate, capital gains tax discount, and possibly stamp duty reform in favor of land value tax. Where do you stand on that? Could we reform negative gearing and CGT and improve the housing market in some way? What's your take?
Yeah, look, I think it's pretty incremental. I think you've got to separate, is this a housing policy or a tax policy? Because as a tax policy, it seems much very fair to reduce the CGT exemption, say from 50% to 25%, or reintroduce indexation. I don't know about quarantining negative gearing, because if you already reduce the CGT exemption, the the future payoff from losing money on an asset goes down. So you wouldn't really want to do it as much anyway. So I think reducing the capital gains tax exemption automatically solves any negative gearing issues. Because why would I buy a loss-making asset if I'm not getting a tax advantage capital gain? The way I craft these tax and finance ideas in the book is to say you can pick and choose who's got access to money and who can outbid the other person, almost the order of the queue at the supermarket. You can reshuffle people by changing who gets taxed and who gets better finance. But at the end of the day, it's not going to have huge price effects unless it really, really binds hard, right? If it really, really, and then people will complain, oh, I can't borrow money to buy a house. We need to relax finance. So yeah, you can definitely change the order of who gets to the queue of home buying. And maybe there can be incremental changes in first home buyers compared to investors. But I just don't see that being significant or long-lasting, unfortunately. I wish it was the case.
Okay. All right, let's run through a few of these questions. Paraphrasing, was Glenn Stevens culpable for a housing bubble? We had 15 years or so of artificially low interest rates, yes or no?
I think we need to be a bit honest that we have decided to manage the macroeconomy through the price of housing. And we've done that for 30 years. And so in a way, that question is correct. However, it's also true that in 2017 to 19, we had quite low interest rates and low prices. It was the best buying opportunity for decades. That's why I bought our house then, or in 2020, I ran out of time before COVID, but that was the best buying opportunity. But yes, it's true that low interest rates keep prices up because of that asset pricing equilibrium. If you can borrow money at 2%, if you're renting money cheaper than you can rent a house, well, prices will go up, right? But if interest rates, you've got to pay on your mortgage 8 or 9% and you're paying for something that yields 4 or 5%, then, that price can't last. Prices.
You could probably argue that if interest rates were artificially low for 15 years, then to some level, fiscal and government settings must have been wrong, because otherwise, why would they be artificially low? Yeah. That kind of makes sense.
So, as a macroeconomic point, I think that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, as somebody who's both an academic and who has worked in the property sector, what are some of the things that economists and people who haven't worked in the sector may fail to understand?
Yeah, thanks, Cameron Kusha.
I put it in as an anonymous question, but you've named and shamed.
So yeah, no, he's a good guy. And it's a good question. So I have thought about this and I haven't come up with a great answer. I think maybe I can just riff on a couple of things. One thing is the risk. A lot of the commentary academia is like, oh, property development is no risk. We're just giving money away. Yet most property developers go broke at some point, right? It's a big risky thing to do. The timing between, contracts and spending and settling, all those types of things, they take a long time. There's a lot of money at stake. And that's why property developers don't just flood the market. It's risky. You've got to get everything in place first. So I think that's probably one big sort of gap between academia that just says, oh, we're giving away money, property developers just make free money all the time. Sometimes we do, but compared to the costs of their projects, so we might give away, $10 billion because we upzone, or $10 million because we upzone, but they might turn around and spend $200 or $300 million on a project. And a lot of people have a lot of money on the line in those things for a long time. And that's why margins are high. And even when they're high, you can still lose money.
Makes sense. Yeah, there's a couple of snarky questions about why you're a denialist on X point and Y point. But let's do one more before we wrap up. Here was a question that was direct message to me. A lot of people seem to believe that because something is academically modeled, it is correct. Please talk to us about why economic models that forecast property prices have been so inaccurate. I guess that's referring to the past few years when I don't think any model could have really accurately predicted some of the policies we've had since 2020. But why these economic models may also poorly forecast the impact of other things, e.g. upzoning, negative gearing removal, etc.
Interesting question. So a few things. There's a model for everything. You know, in academia, you learn that you can find someone who's done research that shows any position you want. It's a big, bad world out there. My approach is to keep looking out the window and going, does that make sense with what I can see out there? And I'll give you a couple of examples. So just remember, as an answer to this question, Eric Crampton, there are good models there that show why property owners don't want to flood the market to reduce the value of their next sale and their next property. But when I started my PhD in 2012, I knocked on the door of every economist academic at UQ and I asked them, you can build, look out the window, you can build towers as far as you can see out this window. There's only one tower after, you know, 10 years. Why? What is everyone waiting for? Why aren't there towers everywhere? What economics reconciles what the sort of supply and demand model of the YIMBYs with no time in the denominator? What reconciles this with my observation out the window? I had to knock on more than a dozen doors. More than a dozen doors before someone said, oh, what you're saying sounds a little bit like real options. You should read Dixit and Pindick's textbook on this. It's all about the value of waiting for large, irreversible construction projects. 12 academics, no idea, hadn't really thought about it. Someone got me onto this, and I realized there's a whole literature out there that is much more tied to the reality that I've observed investing in property, working for the property developers. What property developers say, you know, to their investors in their annual reports, oh, we're going to be patient with this because it's not a good time to sell right now. Okay, great. So you're waiting. So the thing that's regulating the pace of new construction is the market conditions that you're waiting for. Isn't this true during the boom and the bust? Like, isn't it always the case? Modeling can sort of tell you anything. And I think I'm very keen about just looking for what's happened before. That's why I look at New Zealand for stamp duty, you know, getting rid of that and what's going to happen. Why I was so keen on Auckland, looking at that paper, I was just like, okay, for upzoning Auckland in 2016, there was a paper that showed this massive effect. And I just thought, I guess zoning just does what it says. Like, well, not what it says. It regulates the pace as well as the density. Maybe I was wrong. And I was like, I remember being there thinking, oh, okay, well, I guess I've got to update this because what else can I do? But then, of course, when you dig a bit deeper, there are a few dodgy things there. And if you look more broadly, it's just, it's still hard to see any effect.
Yeah, so actually there's been some releases from developers on the ASX just recently where they've talked about, effectively not developing the pipeline that is available to them. And I guess that is the environment we're in, higher costs for construction and trades and higher interest rates and less demand for new builds and so on. So it kind of does underscore that there's always a market cycle. Cam, really enjoyed the read. They would just come up to the hour now. So we'll wrap it up. You've got a very unique way of cutting through the crap and I very much enjoyed the read. So most importantly, where can people get a copy of The Great Housing Hijack?
You can buy it anywhere, any bookstore, local, online, internationally. Go and find the book. But if you want to find me and other writing and details about events for the book and things like that, fresheconomicthinking.com is where you find me.
And are you doing any presentations? I tried to come along to your book launch for Game of Mates, but it was fully sold out, standing room only. So are you doing a live presentation this time?
So there are three events in Sydney starting tonight, this week. Inner West Library, I don't know when you're going to release this. Probably it's too late, 28th of Feb, University of Sydney, 29th of Feb, Macquarie University, 1st of March. The next one after that is at Avid Reader West End in Brisbane on the 13th of March. And then there's in Melbourne at RMIT on the 20th of March and in Canberra on the 21st. These are all on my website, fresheconomicthinking.com. Click on the Great Housing Hijack article and you'll see a list of events there.
Beautiful. Thank you, Cameron. And thanks so much. Appreciate you putting a shirt on and a collar to do this interview. I know it's a bit warm outside today, so we'll let you get back into the board shorts. Thank you so much for joining. Always enjoy our chats and look forward to speaking again soon.
Thanks for having me, Pete. It was great to chat.
Cheers.
Thanks for tuning into the Australian Property Podcast.
If you love the show, why not subscribe or leave us a review on Apple or Spotify?
And if you want to work with me, Amy, Pete, or Chris,
you'll find links in your podcast player to get in contact with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Australian Property Podcast. We're huge advocates of getting the right advice at the right time from the right people. That's why it's important to understand that this podcast episode contained general financial information only. It is not designed to be specific or personalized to your financial, tax, or legal situation. With property, the check sizes are pretty big, so it's important you get advice from a licensed and trusted professional before acting on the information you hear in RASC podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called RASC Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. RASC Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. RASC Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the RASC Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.